This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Looking for a job is lonely. Endless searching, phone calls that go nowhere, applications that vanish into thin air. What if you could link with dozens of local companies who are hiring right now with just one connection? That's Express Employment Professionals. Find us at expresspros.com. One connection, endless opportunities, and no fees ever for job seekers. Express Employment Professionals. Expresspros.com.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Life comes with big money questions. Is it better to max out your 401k or put more in a brokerage account? Does buying a home make financial sense in today's market? Should you use extra cash to pay off debt or invest? NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast has the answers. Their finance journalists break down investing and budgeting strategies to help you build wealth and navigate major financial decisions. Make smarter money moves. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
Now, from Wichita's most listened to sports radio, 97.5 and 1240 KFH, this is Sports Daily with Jacob Albrock and Tommy Gester.
What's up, everybody? Welcome in to Sports Daily here on this Tuesday morning here on KFH. Tommy Gester, Jacob Albrock, Max Power producing the program. The KFH hotline is open for you at 869-1240 this morning. Max Power manning that hotline today. A lot to get to here on the program this morning. The Royals stay hot. They continue to roll with the shutout against Chicago. Cole Reagans look dominant on the mound. We'll get into that a little bit later on in the program today. Our Chiefs insider, Felix Johnson, will join us to talk more about the Chiefs draft picks. We'll get into that and anything else NFL and Chiefs related with him as well. The NBA playoffs continue. Some exciting action last night in the NBA as well. I think we have Jacob. Jacob, good morning, man.
Yeah, I think the folks on the video stream can hear me. Can you hear me, Tommy?
I've got you.
Okay. All right. Here we go. We're rocking and rolling on this Tuesday. Yeah, it was a great night in the NBA playoffs. Maybe I missed stuff in the first round. I picked a good time to get in. Every time I watch a game, they have incredible finishes. Both the road teams winning last night. And, you know, for Thunder fans around here, got some work to do. Aaron Gordon breaking the heart of Thunder fans last night. We had the Knicks get a win on the road against the defending champs. Max and I's Toronto Maple Leafs got a win in game one of their series. And then we had the Royals with their shutout, Tommy. It was a good night of sports. It was not like, that's it. Like you turn it on. Like it was hard to keep up with everything. I was trying to bounce back and forth between the Royals finish and the Knicks Celtics finish, which they went into overtime. And I it was great. It was a great night of sports, I think. And it's a good time. Join me if you haven't been watching the NBA playoffs, because I hadn't been until over the weekend, and they have not let me down yet. These have been really, really good games.
They have been, and this is the time of year when, you know, obviously the NBA is like these playoff matchups. You've got, you know, these teams that are so well matched up against each other. Like, really, the cream does rise to the top. And so, look, I mean, you know, the way that I look at a team like the Knicks, for example, and what they were able to do in overtime against the Celtics last night. It's a Knicks team that Jalen Brunson has been kind of the clutch guy throughout the playoffs so far. He continues that into this series. And, you know, I don't know if anybody is like picking the Knicks to go all the way or anything, but I would suggest that they're probably maybe the top feel-good story, at least so far, in the NBA playoffs. If not, you know, maybe they just are. Maybe they are the top feel-good story of all the teams remaining left in the NBA playoffs. Like, that's fun to watch. Just a lot of really great storylines as we continue.
Yeah, it was, Brunson missing a shot late. That was hard. That was like, you just couldn't believe he missed it. And then they won anyway. It'd be good to see the Knicks make it through. Celtics don't need to win again. Well, nobody needs that. We also had the Shockers yesterday, Tommy, get an addition to the team. We'll get into this in the next segment that it's not even to the point where it like rounds out the class or anything, but man, does it make the class really start to make sense and look pretty good. So that also out there, and we'll get into that one as well. Just want to give it just a little bit more time to kind of look at this class now as it's come together for Wichita State basketball. We know that Wichita State softball begins Wednesday afternoon. So that will be there, and they'll play like at 3 o'clock. So all kinds of little things happening around the area. The Royals last night, Tommy, we can hit on that real quick before we get into it a little more in depth. 3-0 winners. So, you know, kind of the same thing. Cole Reagans, I think first and foremost last night, Cole Reagans looked great. They were, they were careful with him a little bit, you know, letting him go 5 innings and then kind of pulling the plug on that a little bit. But, you know, he's coming off an injury. It makes a lot of sense. He did get up to 94 pitches in 5 innings. That'll happen when you strike out 11 guys in 5 innings. But Reagans looked fine. He looked outstanding. That was probably his best start of the year.
Yeah, he looked really good, striking out 11 in 5 innings. And, you know, I know that when they announced that he was going to pitch today, I was a believer that maybe they should give him a little bit more time. I know they weren't going to put him on the IL, but with how good Noah Cameron looked in his first start in his major league debut, I was kind of the mindset initially that, look, they're playing the White Sox. White Sox are not a very good team. Let's, you know, be very careful with Reagans and maybe have him skip one more start and then have him come back the next time through the rotation. But, you know, once they announced him, I thought, okay, like clearly he's ready to go. And I'm sure that the Royals will be careful with him. And they were. He went 5 innings. You know, I know he had a pitch count up into the 90s, but it wasn't like he went deep into the game, but he was effective in those 5 innings. He was effective in those 5 innings for sure, you know, shutting down the White Sox. And that's really been, it's kind of rinse and repeat for the Royals. Like, it's, you know, score a handful of runs, shut out your opponent, and then on, you know, kind of every few games or so, you can have the bats do what they need to do as well, like what we saw in the finale against Baltimore. So all in all, it was a return back to kind of standard Royals baseball with great pitching, just enough hitting, and they get the job done.
Yeah, Reagans, I think if he was going to miss, if they ever had the intention of him missing another one, they would have put him on the IL. So at minimum, he responded to this injury the way they thought and had hoped. And I think that's good news. He is the ace. Like, he is your dominant pitcher. He did not look good the last time we saw him before the injury. So this was particularly good to see because, I mean, Tommy, there, like, it's going to be pitching. Like, I guess, you know, we're getting into this thing here. 36 games. It's going to be pitching. Like, if it's going to be pitching, they're going to need Cole Reagans. So it was a really good sign to see him get back in. They bullpen in a game where the bullpen needed to give you 4 innings. They now stretch it out. Cruz continues to be a revelation. Lynch, Schreiber continue to be really good. You know that they've got Ursig back there. At some point, you think they're going to get Harvey. And Estevez is fine. He's looking sharp as the closer. Like, I mean, they have so much there. They're so deep in the rotation. They're so deep in the bullpen. I can't imagine, outside maybe the Mets this year so far, we think the Dodgers will be there over time. Like, they're at least, to me, the best pitching in the American League, which is just an insane thing to say if you think back to a couple of years ago, how that's been rebuilt. I mean, you went from almost unusable pitching all over the place to now last year, and then this year they've taken it a step further. offense aside, which it wasn't there enough again last night, that was the best pitcher they'll face, by the way, against the White Sox. Yeah. Shane Smith's been really good.
Like, look, I think you have to have that trade off, and I'm okay with it right now. As long as the pitching is effective, which it absolutely has been, I'm not going to sit here and say, well, the offense wasn't enough. Well, no, it absolutely was enough.
Well, it was enough. Yeah,
they shut out the White Sox like that. Like
they're not letting anybody score.
I mean, they could win this. They could have won that game 1-0, and it would have been enough. You know, so yeah. Would you like to see it be fully complete and have a clicking offense and a clicking pitching staff all the time? Absolutely. You know, but I'm not going to, you know, sit here hand wringing and be like, man, they need to score more runs. Well, do they? Because Cole Reagan shut out the White Sox and everything was good.
It is what it is, right? They're fine now because they're pitching so well. It's okay. I think long term, we just keep watching it because they're going to make a move. They're not going to let this offense be their offensive finish postseason. We'll talk more about the Royals in a little bit, but let's talk Shockers when we come back. Big addition through the portal last night, I think. We'll talk about it next.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
Hey, I'm Tank Sinatra here with my co-host,
Investigator Slater.
And we would like to tell you a little bit about our podcast, Psychopedia.
It's true crime infused with comedy.
Making it a crimedy.
I do extensive investigative research and go deep into the darkest corners of the human psyche.
And I'm just here to lighten things up a little bit with humor, baby. You know, never at the expense of the victims, though, obviously.
Come join our family of little psychos over on Psychopedia. Available on the Odyssey app or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
It's time to get back to the sports talk.
All right, let's do this thing. Go!
Sports Daily is on KFH.
All right, welcome back, everybody. It is Sports Daily, and we are glad to be with you on this Tuesday. Thanks to Prairie Fire Coffee for keeping us fueled up each and every day here in the Odyssey Studios. Tommy, the Shockers get a player that is really interesting. I don't want to overstate anything with a true freshman from Fresno State, but what I take away from Brian Amunike, and I hope I'm saying that right, I have not heard it yet, but the way I look at it is like a need-based thing and trying to figure out the types of players Wichita State needs, wants, whatever. You've got a kid who was a freshman in the Mountain West who late in the year and in conference play really picked it up, almost averaged double digits in conference play, scored double digits in like 9 of his last 14. And it was like upper double digits in a lot of those. He shot a high percentage from 3. Their team was really bad, really, really bad last year. They won a couple of, you know, mail-in games early in the year, and then they won 3 games the rest of the way. That's it. They weren't very good, but he became a good scorer late in the year as his minutes increased. So, look, you look at it, and for me, like, this is exactly the type of player Wichita State needs still on the roster. And you know, we have seen other guys come in that you think could score, but maybe they've been guys who didn't play a ton at bigger schools or they were 6-man. No, he was kind of the focal point for Fresno State, it looks like, down the stretch. And I think you got to be a confident player offensively to do that, even as a freshman. And it looks like he did. And with as much defense and experience and that kind of thing that they've brought in elsewhere on the roster, this seems to fill a really big need for Wichita State next year. And I love it. I think it looks great, at least on paper.
Well, for me, it's really about, you know, the role that he plays and the lack of depth that the Shockers have had in the backcourt. I mean, really, a lot of their new additions recently that we've been talking about have been front court guys, the size, you know, of, you know, 6'9" to 7'2", in the case of the kid that is coming from Purdue. So it's really been about size. It's been about defense, you know, about length, all of that for Paul Mills and what he has prioritized in the portal. And I remember I posed the question, I believe it was last week, when we were talking about the front court of the Shockers, and I posed the question, who's going to be in the backcourt? Like, who's going to be the primary ball handler? Is it going to be Kenyon Giles? Is it going to be Keandre Kendall? What is that going to look like? Both of those guys, while they, you know, should be at least capable of playing in the backcourt for Wichita State, at least I hope they are. We don't know much about either one of them, but I would think that they will be. That neither one of those guys are very big. Like, you know, we're talking 5'9", 5'10", 6', somewhere around there. What this guy brings to the table, the Fresno State transfer, and how'd you say his name, Amunike?
I'm going to say Amunike until Amunike. I get a chance to what, hear otherwise. What so he, apologies.
Yeah, what he brings is obviously being able to play in the backcourt and shoot the ball, score well, but he's also bringing some size and length into the backcourt as well. He's 6'5", and he's going to play in the backcourt. And so I think that that certainly helps out a lot too. You know, I don't know how he grades out defensively, but it certainly seems like the priority for him is to be one of the guys that can come in and put points on the board for Paul Mills. And that's an area where they have been lacking, at least in who they've brought in during the course of this offseason. And so I think it's an intriguing pickup for Paul Mills, especially for a team that has really, really struggled in shooting the basketball in years past. Having somebody come in that kind of seems to be his specialty, I don't know how it will translate at Wichita State and the style of play that Paul Mills wants to have. I'm not sure how it will translate in the American Conference necessarily, but it certainly does, on paper, fill a role that the Shockers desperately need.
Yeah, have needed for a decade or more, outside of one team, right? So, again, this is hard to do because we're watching a highlight clip here and there and, like, looking at game logs when we're dealing with transfer portal players, especially freshmen from a two-win Fresno State team. I get it, but that's all we can do, right? That's the only thing we really can. I love that this is a younger player. I love that I cannot imagine that a young player who shot as well as he did from three would not be coveted in the portal. And so knowing that and the fact that Wichita State was able to go get him, I think is a good sign for the program. Look, I went into this whole process skeptical, right? Like at best. And I do like what they've done. And I've got to be honest with that. Like, I like what they're putting together on paper. We never know how this is going to work out, right? You don't know, especially with the portal, how pieces fit together. It's like, you know, in the old days, a team that graduates 6 or 7 guys every year. Like, you never know until they start playing, but we didn't know that last year either, or the year before. So you look at it, and when I look at what he did, it wasn't all about the three. It was a lot about the three, but he did score in other ways, it would appear. He had high shot volume games. He had games. I'm looking because I just keep looking at this stretch, really, like that was late January where he went down and he scored like 10 of 14 or however you want to look at it, where he really started to score. It's really when his minutes jumped, and you don't know why his minutes weren't there. You assume it's just because he was a freshman. But if you go through and you look at those games, you've got one outlier game where he didn't really play. In all the other games, he shot 50% or better, Tommy, 50% or better from three in all but like three of those games. And he was around 35% or higher in those other three. So, like, even in the games where he wasn't lights out, he would be 1 for 3, 2 for 6, whatever it is. Like, this consistently hit threes down the stretch. I don't know if he's going to come into Wichita State and they're going to say, all right, we want you to take 4 or 5 threes a game. Maybe they do. But it does look like he can score in other ways. And no matter what it is, when we looked at what was coming together on paper, it was lacking offense, right? It looked great defensively. They got their two bigs who look like they're just going to be bigs that can give you the defensive presence of a big. Maybe one of their offensive skill sets develop, but that's going to be a big loss with Quincy Ballard down. So it was all about defense, 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 which I love, by the way. I'm on the record of saying that. They did need some, you know, some splash offense, and it looks like they got one here. Are they finished? I have no idea. They still have a roster spot. I'm going to guess without knowing, because I haven't seen any of this, that this was a pretty big swing in the portal. Just on paper, from what we're hearing guys get, a freshman that can score and can shoot threes could not have been, like, I would imagine his list of suitors was long.
Yeah, and maybe you're probably right about that, but I do think it is important to temper expectations a little bit here because it's not even necessarily about, you know, the player himself, because yeah, on a team that was not very good last year in Fresno State, he was effective offensively and shot the ball really well, especially down the stretch. It's more about we've seen players that have been touted as good shooters play for Wichita State, and I'm going back, you know, multiple years
it just doesn't
translate. And you know, I've heard a lot of people over the years be like, it's something about Cocorina, you know, where like just shooting is just difficult in there. And I don't know, I'm not going to get
it
into that.
It doesn't translate on the road though.
Yeah, so exactly. So I don't know if it's because we've seen this happen with Paul Mills teams, we've seen it happen with Isaac Brown teams, we saw it happen with Greg Marshall teams, you know, outside of that one year where it's not like you're talking about teams that are lighting it up from three. Three of the last four seasons, so even going back into the Isaac Brown era, and this is from Taylor Eldridge, Wichita State ranked as one of the worst three-point shooting teams in the entire country. And so having a freshman from Fresno State who finished 6-26 last year, and he's a good shooter, don't get me wrong. Well, that's nice to have him on the roster. I want to temper expectations and not go in being like, man, he's going to be the guy that is going to, you know, put up 20 plus points a game shooting it from long distance for Wichita State. He might, he probably has the talent to be able to do so. I'll see it. I'll believe it when I see it, just because of the way historically guys shoot, you know, with Wichita State.
It doesn't mean they're going to be a great 3-point shooting team if he can shoot the three well. You know what I mean? Like, that doesn't mean all of a sudden that's going to be the strength of this team. It means they have one guy, it would appear, that can shoot the three. And they've had, and a couple other guys, and this has been pointed out, don't shoot a high volume, but have been moderately effective. They're not going to be one of the best 3-point shooting teams in the country. Like, we can set that
aside. But they don't need to be. They don't need to be.
They don't, right. But they do need guys that can hit open threes from time. I shouldn't say this definitively because we never know. But I don't think like they're going to go into next season and be like, all right, guys, I want us taking a ton of threes. That's going to be our offense. I don't think that's going to happen. That doesn't mean you don't need to make some threes.
Sure,
though.
Absolutely. You need to have that in your arsenal at least, but they're not going to live and die by the 3-point shot. At least I don't think so. I don't think that's been their MO forever. So I'm not, you know, that's, I feel like if there had been, if there was an expectation on Amunike coming in and being this lights out sharpshooter that is going to be the guy that leads them offensively, it'd be a different conversation. While he may be a really good shooter and has an opportunity to grow and take steps forward, and I think he's a nice addition for the Shockers, I think it's important to call him what he is. And what he probably will be in this system, and that is somebody that they can rely on, hopefully, to be able to hit some open threes when needed, when called upon, but probably not the focal point of the offense.
See, that's what I don't know. I would not be surprised if a player that's young, that came on late in the season, now with on what we expect to at least be a competitive, good team and a good conference, like it with the right opportunity, and this is what gets so tricky about the portal, right? With the right opportunity, what's there for you? We saw, I mean, you got to go back in history and look at this. Sometimes guys take advantage of it. Sometimes guys don't, right? Like it sort of depends. Colby Rogers thrived in that role, right? You go back, Justin Hill did not last year thrive in that role. He did for a minute, and then he did not. Ricky Council, people probably thought, should have had more of the opportunity to do that because it was looking like he could be the guy to do that. And I would fall into that camp. Like, he should have been given more opportunities because of his ability and what he was showing you. I absolutely think a guy coming into his sophomore season who became, you know, the offensive focal point for his team in the Mountain West, by the way, which is a better league than the AAC. Fresno State's not a better team, but that's a better league that he was doing this up against than what the AAC was a year ago. And so, yeah, I do think there's a chance he comes in and becomes the – I mean, he's not a freshman anymore.
I mean, think about it this way. So, you know, Wichita State shot just over 30% from beyond the arc last year, 30.2%. Did not grade out well at all in that category. In a low volume. So they didn't take a lot of threes. They didn't make a lot of threes, but they were just over 30%. I think if you were to say, okay, Amunike coming in and what he can do shooting the three, you know, if he can get them single-handedly up to maybe around 35% as a team collectively shooting the three, if he can improve them 5 percentage points year over year, I think you would take that. I think you would call that a success.
Absolutely.
I don't think you're going to come in and be like, okay, this guy single-handedly by himself is going to get Wichita State up over 40% shooting. Like that, that's unrealistic, right? Like,
I don't care about that.
I think it's more about like, hey, can he collectively get us out of the gutter, you know, get us out of the cellar shooting threes, because he hopefully will have some opportunities to take some open threes and maybe make them and that sort of thing, to get them incrementally better at that position. I think, in my opinion, and maybe I'll be proven wrong. Hopefully I am. Hopefully he's this lights-out dynamite offensive threat for Wichita State. But in my mind, I see his addition and his role to incrementally get the Shockers better offensively. If that means if he can get you up, you know, another 5 percentage points, that's fantastic. 2 percentage points, I think we'll take it. Like, anything above where they have been in shooting the three nationally, I think you take that as a win.
See, I don't even care about what it does for the team. All I care about is that this team has a guy that can score 12 or 13 points a game. That's it for me. So, you know, if he can, and that's where I'm focused. I don't know what he's going to do philosophically to the 3-point shooting woes of the entire team. I have no idea.
It's cause and effect. If he does that, the other, like, what one thing happens,
I think he might. But what I guess what I'm saying is, like, stylistically, I don't know that they're going to become a good 3-point shooting team. I'm more concerned that this team, like what we would perceive maybe as a starting five or whatever, a rotation, has a guy that can go get 12 or 13 points.
I mean, I think the other thing to keep in mind too, and this, again, this makes it so difficult in this era with the transfer portal, because yeah, they went out and got this kid. He may not even play. I mean, like, I think he's probably talented enough to play for sure with what he did last year on a bad Fresno State team. But there have been plenty of times where, not just with Wichita State, with teams in general, you're like, hey, they went and got this guy, and then the guy never plays. So who knows? I mean, we have no idea.
That is absolutely the most difficult part. At least, and that's why we started this conversation, like, on paper, we're guessing, like, I don't know about any of these players. You know, like, what's to say a SoCon Defensive Player of the Year translates to the AAC either? Like, we're guessing, and we have no reservations.
Is the 7'2" guy?
We're absolutely guessing. Everybody,
the 7'2" guy who played 3 minutes a game for Purdue, is he going to play? I mean, I don't know. I mean, how does that translate to American play? He's 7'2". Like, does that translate well? I mean, we don't know. On paper, you know, sure. Like, you've got the size, you've got the prowess, I guess, and the Big Ten experience, at least in a limited capacity. Does that translate? Well, I mean, we're just taking shots in the dark here. It's kind of like throwing darts, and until we actually see it round into form, we don't know for sure.
We don't, and we won't. And that's the most difficult part of this. Some people enjoy the portal, and I understand why. I get it. I get the reason for it. It's like free agency every year. For me, though, it's the total unknown is difficult. And this is the first year we've had like essentially every team in the country with a total unknown. In years past, you've had some returners and everything else. This year, it's been everybody just jumps in and everybody totally rebuilds their roster. So we're all guessing. I mean, that's what it is. Is that ideal? Of course it's not. And is that going to be forever? I don't think so. But until we do, this is what we have. And so as we look at things on paper, and look, I thought K-State, the collection of players they put together a year ago, looked like it would make great sense and be a great team. And for a small stretch of the season, they were absolutely that. And for more of the season than not, they were not very good. So who knows? Who knows, right? Until we see him play. And it's a roller coaster ride of a season anyway. But when we evaluate the whole thing and know that Wichita State lost all its players, most notably Quincy Ballard and Corey Washington, right? Those guys weren't coming back. When we learned that, it's like, well, now what do they do? We've had all the talk of needing $1 million and all these things. I think they've done a good job. I do. I think that they have put together on paper a collection of players that makes sense, right? All right, Tommy, we come back. It's just crazy. What were we laughing at the other day? It was a team in the NBA playoffs. I don't remember which one it was. Missed 40 threes. Well, the Celtics missed 45 of them last night. That is wild to me to think about that many threes. It's just crazy. We can get into the NBA playoffs a little bit in the next hour.
I mean, it's must-see TV, right? I'm like, where else are you going to get a team missing 40-some threes in a game?
I don't like the chuck it style of the – I get it. I understand it. I know why it's happening. Analytics, all that. They're better shooters now. I get all of that, but I don't like it. Like, it's not as good to my eyes. But that's okay. Like, every style works, and it didn't work last night for the Celtics. So the Knicks are up 1-0. And we get the other two. All the road teams so far, we haven't seen Minnesota and Golden State, but right now all the road teams have won their game ones, which has been another interesting part of that. Let's dig in a little further on the Royals, Tommy. We touched on it just briefly there. Reagans, we touched the best sign of the night. It's Cole Reagans. Without question, undoubtedly, I think the second best sign is that they just continue to find effective bullpen arms. Those things could last the entire season and make the lack of offense we've seen through the first 35, 36 games less important, still important, but less important, especially in the short term when they're playing in a division that appears to be really, really good. The other thing for me that I think last night I take away from is Jonathan India. I think it was, I don't remember which of the announcers or whether it was listening to it on the radio on the way home or whether I was watching it when I got home. One way or the other, it was something like he has been on base in the last, is it four games or something? 9 out of 17 times, like just a crazy rate. He is really coming on. And it was Hudler, I know, who talked during the game after, I think it was his second hit, that it's taking him some time, but it appears he has learned now. He's got to stop trying to get him out of the yard at Kauffman. Like stop trying to hit the ball in the air. Like that kind of power it's a different kind of power to be able to get it out consistently at Kauffman. So refocus your approach at the plate, especially in that ballpark. And whatever it is, it's working. And India is starting to get on at a pretty crazy rate, quite frankly. And if that continues, it'll take some of the pressure off of the middle of the order. But, you know, I would tell you most nights when Salvi and Vinny go a collective 0 for 7, the Royals are going to struggle to score runs. I mean, that's pretty simple. I mean, those two guys have got to be the guys.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think India has, you know, shown that he understands what that role is. And we've seen his, you know, his OPS climb and his batting average climb. At one point, a couple of weeks ago, when the Royals were down in the dumps and they were not scoring any runs, they were losing games. That road trip was really difficult for them back last month. I mean, India's batting average dropped under 200, and you're kind of like, man, what's happening here? And he was still getting on base, I guess, halfway decently. He was walking occasionally and like that sort of thing, but it wasn't at the clip that we wanted to see. You know, since that time, he's got his batting average all the way up to 230, which is not lighting the world on fire, but it's significantly better than what it was. And he's got that OPS, you know, up to 639. I mean, literally, it's right behind Salvador Perez from an OPS perspective, and it's above Vinny Pasquantino's OPS right now. You know, so he is producing and doing the things that he needs to do. He's not stealing bases, but that really hasn't, that's really never been, I think, an expectation for him necessarily, even though he's at the very top of the lineup. His expectation is get on base, get moved over, and score runs. That's why he's there, and he's doing that at a much higher clip than he was.
I don't care if he steals bases or not, because if he does, he ends up at second and gives the other team the option of picking in a Bobby Witt Jr. So I don't like that anyway. I mean, it's fine if he wants to steal bases from time to time, but I don't think that needs to be a part of his
game. Yeah, that's not been an expectation, I don't think, of his.
OPS you mentioned there. Look, that's all. I'm glad he's climbing above those guys. That's still below league average. What I don't know with him, though, like, is his ever going to get that high? Because if he really has changed his approach, like it was suggested in the broadcast, that's going to mean a lot of singles, right? And not a lot of power. OPS, to calculate it, needs some of that slug. Well, you're not going to get a lot of that slug if you're a singles hitter, right? It sort of reminds me, as I've watched him lately, you remember Michael Young? I know Rangers fans obviously love him. But dude always was up in the league and hits and everything else, was a lot of singles. And so a lot of people didn't value him the same way. But in reality, if you watched him every day, it was insanely valuable, right? His ability to get on base. And so I don't know how much higher the OPS is going to be. He is a career league average OPS guy, which is around 750. So he's pretty well below where his average is getting, but he's been playing half his games every year in perhaps the most hitter friendly park in the big leagues. So we've got to take some context in with that. I think for this team, how he performs just getting on base in general is probably more important. I don't know that his slug or OPS, though, is going to get very high playing at Kauffman. But I do think his on-base percentage can easily get back to at least where it is over the course of his career, which is still just a little bit higher than it is in totality this year. So his game seems to be rounding into form. He has been a good drink, you know, stirrer for this offense for the last couple of weeks. And I think we're seeing him find his groove for sure.
They absolutely had to have somebody at the top of that lineup who could get on base, yes, and they could set the table for Bobby Witt Jr., Pasquantino, and Perez. That's why they brought him in. They needed that. I mean, there were so many times last season that it was an automatic out basically at the top of the lineup, and Bobby Witt Jr. would come to the plate with one out and nobody on. And, you know, I don't care how Jonathan Indy is doing it. I don't care if he's hitting a bunch of singles. I don't care if he's walking. I don't care how he's doing it necessarily, as long as he is setting that table for them. And to put it in perspective, like, again, I don't particularly care about the slugging numbers, and I know that that goes into OPS. But if you just want to look at on-base percentage, among players that are regularly playing for the Royals, he's third in OBP right now, behind Michael Garcia and Bobby Witt Jr. That's what you need from him. That's literally the reason why he's there offensively, and the fact that you add on his versatility in the field and the fact that he can play multiple positions and the Royals are able to deploy him in multiple places depending on their need, depending on the situation, and depending on the game and their opponent. Again, that's exactly why he's there. I think he's for sure fulfilling why he's on that roster, and I'm good with it. I've been great with Jonathan Indias since day one, even when he was kind of grinding and struggling through that tough stretch, when everybody was kind of grinding and struggling through that tough stretch. I still believe that, I mean, he was still getting on base. He was walking a ton. And so I've been a big fan of Jonathan Indias, and I think he's absolutely rounding into form.
Yeah, I do too. And it's not like, so that's the, and then the reality, when I look at it, is they still have to get more from Vinny and Salvi. And that's not going to change, right? That's always going to be the case. They're going to get Bobby Witt Jr. has been great. Michael Garcia has been great. But to me, like, as we're seeing this stretch out over time, the biggest difference between the offenses a year ago. It's that those guys last year were two of the best RBI players in baseball, both packed in the middle of the Royals lineup. So they need some of that back, because if you look at the lineup, right now, India, we're all good with, right? We all like India. Bobby Witt Jr. is Bobby Witt Jr. Mikel Garcia right now is hitting in the five hole. He's been fantastic. Drew Waters is down there, right? Kyle Isbell provides his defense and the things he does. So, you know, Michael Massey had a big offer again yesterday, but there's not even a lot of like room for somebody to come in anyway. Cags would give this team something they desperately need, which is power, right? They need that. That's pretty obvious, and he could easily do it at a corner outfield spot. So we can set that to the side. But even if they do, and I do think they will, get aggressive when the time comes, it's hard to imagine where they're even going to put it, right? Because right now it's more about, like, you know what? You're not replacing Salvi and Vinny, right? You're not doing anything, but that's where
That's off the table. I mean, I think it is with Vinny. I mean, I think that we need Vinny's batting average to improve. Salvador Perez
is 238 right now.
Yeah, but what has Salvi done in the last 2 weeks, the last 3 weeks? Like,
he has heated up
for sure. He's second on the team in doubles. He's third on the team in hits. He's third on the team in RBIs. That's right where you need him to be. He did not have a good start to the season. I think we all know that, and he got off to a slow start. He has rounded into form. I'm not concerned about Salvi whatsoever. And honestly, I'm not super concerned about Vinny either. I mean, you know, he's hitting more home runs than anybody else. He's, you know, he's getting bad. I mean, he's always hit the ball hard, you know, throughout the course of this season. Yeah, that you look at the totality of this entire season, and Vinny's batting under 200. Salvi's batting 238. All of that. And so, yeah, you need to see more consistency for sure from those two guys in the heart of your lineup. But at least during, and I guess my overall point in all of this is that the Royals are the hottest team in all of baseball. And so rather than nitpicking on, well, this guy's only batting 238 right now, they're the hottest team in baseball. Like, they're figuring it out. Like, it's working for them right now. And the guys in the heart of the lineup are producing at a higher clip than they were 2 or 3 weeks ago. So I'm all good with it. Like, I'm off that train right now of they've got to do something. They've got to bring up Cags, or they've got to get aggressive with somebody and trade. Like, they're the hottest team in Major League Baseball. Their pitching is elite. The lineup, yeah, there are deficiencies for sure, but they're compensating, and everything is working and clicking right now. So let's leave well enough alone.
Well, it's not, I'm not complaining about this. I'm not saying they're not playing well. It's none of that. It's like, I expect this team to be able to compete for a World Series. So that's all I'm looking at. Like, and Salvador Perez, by the way, has been the catalyst for the win streak.
Totally.
If you go back and you look at what his numbers were when the win streak, since they started this stretch, which was the final game of the Detroit series, his batting average, Tommy, has raised 53 points.
Absolutely, it has.
His on-base percentage has raised 50. He isn't hitting any home runs. I don't think he has a home run in that stretch.
Yeah, but he's a doubles machine. I mean, he has
an obscene amount of doubles. Yeah. It's like 5, 6, 7, 8 doubles over those, whatever it is, 12 games. So he's been the catalyst for the turnaround. They just need to continue. I think they will. I love Salvador Perez so much. He's such a fun player to watch. And yes, everything's going great. It's just, you know, is this team a team like, you know, I think I do. I'm not backing off my prediction that they're going to the World Series out of the American League. So everything's with a microscope with that expectation. In the micro, though, like, yeah, it's going great. Still is for the stinking Tigers, too, and the Guardians, who keep winning. This division's wild down the stretch. Three really good teams, and the Twins are heating up, too. We might get into the rest of the division in the next hour. We'll come back, though. Another hour of Sports Daily. We got Felix Johnson this hour to talk some Chiefs. Dahl Brockton Caster, don't go.
Now, from Wichita's most listened to sports radio, 97.5 and 1240 KFH, this is Sports Daily with Jacob Albrock and Tommy Gester.
All right, welcome back in, everybody. It is Sports Daily. Jacob Albrock, Tommy Caster here. Thanks for listening to us on KFH. Thanks for watching on Facebook, on YouTube, on X, listening to us on the Odyssey app, whenever and wherever that is. Lots of different ways to get in touch with the program. You can do it on all the different ways to do it. You can also just send us a message. And Max has texted me during the break, and I've got a request for Max. First, Max, I've been asked to give a Carolina Hurricanes game one preview tonight, taking on the Capitals. I'm going to need your help on that, Max. What are we thinking here? Who are you picking in this series?
Ovechkin, highly overrated.
Ooh.
But I... If I was commissioner of the NFL, under the NHL, there would be no team in Carolina, Dallas, Anaheim, Florida, but I don't know. I'd go with Washington.
Oh boy!
Just because
you're not a popular guy, Max. I got nothing. I don't know.
I'd go with Washington tonight.
I don't really like the Capitals. I don't know why.
I don't either.
I have no reason for that. So, I mean, there's that. That's all the analysis I got. And then you're texting me.
Are they home? Who's home? I don't know who's. Carolina's probably home.
Carolina's home tonight. Carolina's home. Sorry. No, Washington is home tonight. Carolina is the road team.
And I take Washington
for this game one. So you're texting me during the break. We're talking about the Celtics missing 45 threes. And what did you say? You said like the 86 and 87 Lakers or the 83 76ers would go undefeated. And
undefeated.
Max, have you been hanging out with Rick?
No, undefeated.
Rick, our great YouTube viewer.
Undefeated. Those three teams would go undefeated in today's NBA.
I've actually had this discussion with somebody.
Depending on the rules they play by, it would be how much they
win. You go. There's the asterisk you need. Like, which era are they playing? Are you trying to take the 83 76ers and put them up against the, 2023 Celtics? Because 2023 Celtics would win that series.
No, they wouldn't. They would be destroyed.
Are you taking that Celtics team and going back in time to an era where they allowed guys to beat the hell out of each other? It's all relative, right? Like which era are you playing in? Because if those older teams played in today's era, they'd get demolished because these teams would shoot them out of the gym. They'd shoot a million threes. Those teams weren't three teams. Did we even have a 3-point line yet in 1983?
Yes, they did. Come on now.
Barely.
I know you guys weren't born. I know you guys weren't born.
10 threes a game.
Listen,
right?
They'd pass the ball into McHale. All the guys would foul out within no time.
That's right. And so, because I heard this, I think it was Brandon Zinner, another host of the show here, when I brought up Brunson, I think we were talking about Jalen Brunson, and I was like, man, he seems to have like that Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant thing. And he was like, oh, Michael Jordan played against a bunch of nobodies. And I'm like, yeah, look, because that comes up when you talk about Jordan versus LeBron, like who did they play against? I do think LeBron has played in a more complete and a deeper NBA. But I also think it's impossible to say that because Jordan played with a bunch of guys who wanted to kill him every night. They wanted to take his head off.
That was a game plan for a lot of people. That was just Detroit.
So, like, when we have these discussions in the NBA, and I'm not sure you could have the same kind of discussion in the NFL, right? How would Dick Butkus hold up in today's NFL or whatever you want to say? Like, there are transcendent players, sure, but like the rules change in all these sports, other than baseball, where it hasn't really changed, right? It's pretty much the same. Guys throw harder. That's about it. The game hasn't really changed. I mean, golf, I suppose, Tommy, you could take guys and plant them into different eras.
Well, you have to take into account different equipment in both baseball and golf.
Well, you'd give Jack Nicklaus Scottie Scheffler's equipment, and Jack Nicklaus would win a whole bunch of events on tour if he was in his prime, right? His swing is...
I mean, Jack Nicklaus already won a bunch of events on tour
in his prime. I'm saying? Pick another golfer, whatever it is. Gary Player, I don't know. Like, whoever was really good back then would still be really good with the same equipment. So, like, it's hard.
But then everybody else gets the same equipment, too. Like, it becomes relative, So, Jack Nicklaus in golf won with his equipment in the same era that everybody else played with the same equipment. You know, Scottie Scheffler is winning with this equipment currently,
right.
And everybody else is playing with the same equipment too currently. So,
but the rules didn't change, right? The rules haven't changed. And so, like, when we talk about basketball especially, like, the rules are changing. Like, how can you, and football's the same way. Like, the rules are literally different than when these other guys played. So you can't, like, you can't, I don't know who would win these. I'd love to see it. But yeah, if you planted today's teams into 1983, they would get killed, figuratively and literally. But if you took those older teams and put them in today's NBA, they'd get run out of the gym.
No.
By these dudes who are better athletes, who can all shoot threes, like, it's hard to say it. Like, I get it. Like, I'm going to guess Max prefers the style of the NBA in 1983. I probably prefer the style of the NBA in 1983. I would rather see a little more physicality and
I think the NBA is borderline unwatchable until you get to this point in the season. And even then, you know, like the Celtics missing 45 threes or whatever they did in the game last night. Nobody wants to watch that. I don't want to watch that. I'm not going to be like, man, I really got to turn on my TV because I'm going to watch the Celtics miss 45 threes in a game. Like, I'll pay more attention now that we're into the playoffs. You know, once we get into the conference finals, once we get into obviously the NBA finals, all of that, like, yeah, for sure. Like, I'll be paying that much more attention. But I don't ever sit down and think, what am I going to watch tonight? Oh, I'm going to watch the NBA in the regular season when I don't know 80% of the players on the floor. Because of stars aren't playing all the time, like whatever. And it's just like jacking up shots left and right. I don't find that entertaining.
Yeah, it's a part of the problem. I think there's no doubt about it. It's part of the problem for a lot of people. It gets better in the postseason than it is in the regular season, I think. And again, it's just.
Yeah,
it's
last night's Celtics example is, you know, that. Definitely, you know, makes
younger,
a lot of sense.
Younger people, though, that are in tune with that style of basketball are fine with it. It's the same in college. I mean, they're taking more three. They just shoot a much lower percentage. Like, they don't shoot them nearly as well in college, but they're taking a ton. It does beg the question, and I've heard this before, should they back up the three-point line again? I don't even know that that would help. The kind of range that guys have now, I don't even know that that's a deterrent. The problem is, it's the, you know, analytically and like stylistically, it's kind of the way you win games now. You a high volume of threes because guys have become such good shooters. Like that's the style that is conducive to winning and okay. Like you call it the Steph Curry effect. You can call it whatever you want. It is what it is. I don't know what you can do to change it. Baseball ran into this same problem. The shift was hurting baseball. Like it was hurting baseball. Baseball was in a bad, and they were able to fix it. I don't know what you could fix in basketball where you don't have 45 missed threes. We saw it was the Timberwolves missed 40 threes in a game. Like that isn't good television. Like we'd much rather see dudes dunking on each other and doing all that kind of stuff, which is a generation ago. It feels like now.
Here's an idea. Make an adjustment. You know, like it doesn't necessarily have to be like we need
what
to.
What can you do? That's my question.
Not shoot threes. Try to play.
But that's how you win games, though. That's like telling teams, well, don't shift. But the shift is helping them win games. Of course, they're going to do it.
Would the Celtics have won the game if they had maybe moved away, made an adjustment in the second half with that strategy, and maybe tried to take fewer threes and actually try to convert
The Celtics more are the high percentage champions.
It seems like simple math to me. Higher percentage shots. If you make a handful more of those and you're not just jacking up threes that you're missing left and right, clearly it wasn't their night shooting. I'm not saying that they're never going to make threes, but in that particular game, in game one, it's not working for you for whatever reason. Make an adjustment late in the game. Go for some higher percentage shots. You win the game if that's the case.
That's not what I mean. I'm not talking about a single game.
I'm talking about in the game last night, they missed 45 threes. Make an adjustment in the game. In that game, if you're the Celtics, make an adjustment, you win the game.
Totally. I don't disagree with that. I'm talking about how do you like what can basketball do where a team's not inclined to take 63?
I don't know. I don't. I mean, I to be completely honest with you, I don't particularly care. Because it, to me, I don't think that you can do a whole lot just in the way that the game is presented now to where like that can get fixed. I guess I'm a pessimist in that regard. I don't think you're not going to roll the game back, right? Like that, you talked about golf. That's been an argument in golf is they've rolled the golf ball back, you know, or that they're working on that. They're talking about that, like taking distance off the golf ball so, you know, golfers are not able to hit it 500 yards and just, you know, shred up courses left and right. I don't exactly know. Unless you made the three-point line at the half-court line, I don't know if that's even, you know, realistic to even talk about in the NBA. I think the product that we have is the product that we're going to continue to have in the NBA.
I agree. And young people like it. The people that grew up on Steph like it. It's the style of basketball that they're used to. I get it. And that's where I was giving Max a hard time. Max's style that he grew up with happened, you know, a long, 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 long time ago.
They were still shooting the ball in peach buckets when...
That's right.
Peach baskets or that's whatever right. It was when Max was watching.
Max ran into Dr. James Naismith on the street one time. Yeah. All right, we'll come back. More Sports Daily. Felix Johnson. We'll talk a little football next.
Okay, take it easy. We're going on the air.
This is Sports Daily on KFH. And now, digging deeper with the teams you follow, it's another Sports Daily Insider interview on KFH.
And that insider is Felix Johnson, Arrowhead Addict. Insider for the Kansas City Chiefs for us here on Sports Daily. Always appreciate that. Field Vision as well for the work for Felix. All right, Felix, the Chiefs talk, rookie camp. What are you watching the most with these rookies? Is it simple this time of year? Is it, does Josh Simmons work? Is he healthy? Like, is it that simple for what we should be looking for?
I think it is. I think particularly with when you look at what the Chiefs need moving forward. Like, again, we've talked about how they're probably going to be in the contenders race just because they're the Kansas City Chiefs and their quarterback is who he is. But at the same time, you need to protect that guy. And I think that they've done the things in the draft and free agency to move in that direction. And now it's just like, all right, can Josh start week one? And it depends on whether or not he can. I'm not sure. And they signed Moore in free agency and Thomas, trying to figure out whether or not they're going to start him and figure out what the case may be heading into the week one. But again, I think this is going to be a long-term situation where halfway through the season, I don't think the left tackle spot's going to be solved. It may not be as big of a problem as it was last year, but Josh Simmons seems to be the solution, but it may take him half the season because of injuries and he's a rookie.
How do you feel about, I know that, you know, we've seen some of these guys, you know, start to get some work and, you know, be able to start to get acclimated with the system and everything that Andy Reid implements there in Kansas City, specifically with a guy like Jalen Royals, you know, coming in and trying to compete for a wide receiver role on the team. I've seen some comps that, you know, he's a little bit Rashee Rice-esque in his game. How well do you think what he brings to the table can translate offensively to what Kansas City wants to do?
Well, I think it's kind of what Kansas City has tried to do with Rashee Rice and kind of even before him is that the second time that Patrick Mahomes won the MVP, it wasn't these deep down the field throws. It was kind of this going back to the West Coast offense of these stick routes, these slant routes, these shorter routes. And then what can you do breaking off of that? Rashee Rice is a great yak receiver, and we'll see if Royals can fit into that realm too. So I think that's where the Chiefs are heading now, where it's like, all right, we'll get you the ball in a slant 5 yards off the ball, but break it for 15, 20 yards more or whatever the case may be. Obviously, they want to go deep down the field like you saw at the end of the Super Bowl a little bit too much too late. But at the same time, if you can get the easy yardage of get the ball into the playmaker's hands and move forward, I think Royals fits into that archetype, if you will.
We ran a scenario yesterday for the Chiefs on the offensive line. If there was a scenario where Jalen Moore looks good, and let's just say Simmons is healthy, do you think the Chiefs are willing and ready to make Juwan Taylor the third man in the rotation?
I think it's kind of hard to pay a guy $80 million over the course of...
What if he's the third best player?
And that very well might be the case, and trade him then. I mean, that's if he's worth $80 million to you, and he's probably worth, depending on where the tackle market is at that point in the season, trade him. I honestly, he's not worth the dollar amount. And, I mean, you saw last year when Christian Darrisaw went down for the Vikings, the Jags traded for they traded for a Jags tackle and got him. And so, like, there's going to be a tackle market. Somebody's going to get hurt in the middle of the season. Juwan Taylor might be able to slot in for whomever that team is, and you have that in the middle of the season. If that is the case, I don't know if he's going to be the third best player. I'm not sure if Moore is going to be that guy or if Simmons is going to be healthy early enough, and so they may need Juwan Taylor to just be the right tackle. But at the same time, it's the most expensive third tackle in the game if that's the case, and that won't last longer than this season if that were the case.
Let's talk tight end a little bit, Felix. One of the other notes from rookie camp is, you know, from an undrafted guy, Jake Briningstool, that the Chiefs signed, and they like him. They think he's impressive, and potentially, you know, battling for a backup role on this team. Apparently, he made, at least in day two of rookie camp the other day, made two of the top plays. That's according to Matt McMullen, who reports for the Kansas City Chiefs, and that the team really likes him. What do you know about him? Is he somebody that could legitimately make the team and could, you know, have some production for Kansas City?
I just think that tight end room is kind of full right now. Obviously, Travis Kelce at the top of it. Then Noah Gray had a solidifying performance. I think he's the heir apparent for whenever Travis Kelce retires, whether that's probably after this year. And then they've used draft capital on Jared Wiley, and I think that he's a guy that they're going to be looking at just to be like, all right, if this year doesn't work out, then we'll look at an undrafted free agent. And they're probably not going to keep four tight ends on the roster on opening day. He'll probably get a practice squad invitation or whatever the case may be. But at the same time, just about every year, there's a tight end or a receiver that the Chiefs have that are like, oh, snap, look at this guy. And then it's like, okay, he's going to get cut, Nico Remigio, or whatever the case may be. And I think we're in May. We're looking for things to talk about. He's just going to be a guy that's either going to get cut or be on the practice squad. And, I mean, if this is the case where he's going to get play time and get some snaps and whatever the case may be, awesome. But I like to be a little realistic when it comes to undrafted free agents. Most of them aren't going to make the roster.
What about when the season starts? All right, we've got rookie camp, this early off-season work. Felix Johnson, our Chiefs insider. So now we're talking veterans. We're kind of talking everybody. As we make our way through the summer and towards OTAs and all of these things, what are you looking for here? They brought everybody back. Mm-hmm. There really aren't that many questions for this team. So what should we be on the prowl for? Is it a redesigned offense with all the receivers healthy, maybe? I don't know.
I think hopefully we get a quiet offseason. If you remember last offseason after the Super Bowl, there were arrests and Rashee Rice. Like, there was so many different things going on. I think this year, and we've talked about it, where most of this secondary, most of the defense, and a lot of the offense, if you want to go that case, they haven't had any form of adversity. And this is the first shot at it, I guess, if you will, where they lost the Super Bowl by a giant margin. And like you said, there's not a ton of changes that they can make, and they haven't made any just because they've brought everybody back. And it makes sense too, if you can, a team that's been to the last three Super Bowls and won two of them. So it's hard to say, like, what are they going to change massively, because you can't really change things that grand. And so I think that there's only one team in the NFL that can beat the Chiefs the way the Eagles beat the Chiefs, and that's the Eagles. And so it's about trying to figure out how they can maximize this era right now. And right now, that's they can make it to the AFC Championship game like they have the last 7 years. They can win the Super Bowl like they have two out of the last three with this current roster. It's about the little tweaks and the little changes that they're going to make. I'm not going to have a ton of worry about the Kansas City Chiefs unless they were to lose three or four games in a row like they did in 2023. So it's such a weird spot to be an analyst or whatever you want to say for the Chiefs, just because it's like, yeah, I know they're holding pattern, even though they need to make every change in the book as in regards to their last game. But at the same time, what changes do you make? You can't, because everybody's coming back and you're one of the best teams in the league.
The running back room, I find to be really fascinating for Kansas City, because I think that in an ideal world for the Chiefs, everything pans out and everything looks good in that room, where you've got Isaiah Pacheco as your RB1, kind of your bell cow running back, and then he can get spelled by Kareem Hunt from time to time. Maybe Elijah Mitchell can have a little bit of a resurgence. And then we don't know a whole lot about Breshard Smith other than the fact that he's a really solid pass catcher out of the backfield. That's all well and good if everything goes according to plan. But if Isaiah Pacheco goes down with an injury, which we've seen happen multiple times, I don't really know what direction they go other than just completely abandoning the run game. Do you see any other kind of angle where they, you know, could say, hey, Pacheco, you're out for a while. This is going to be our backup plan, and it's going to be successful for them.
You know, it's kind of interesting that you talk about the running back position like it's a quarterback. Like that, you described everything there. Like if you would have said Patrick Mahomes' name instead of Isaiah Pacheco, it sounds like you'd be just as worried with the backup quarterback as you are with Kareem Hunt. And so it's like that across the NFL. You look at Saquon Barkley and the drop-off to his backup, Derrick Henry and the drop-off to his backup. So it's the only position in the league, or the only other position other than quarterback, where there's only one on the field at a time. Sure, they get rotated in and out, but there's only one on the field at a time. Man, fullbacks are dead. But I think that we're kind of entering that spot where you kind of have to have that guy, where it's maybe not your Saquon Barkley or Derrick Henry, and you're not going to have Patrick Mahomes and Josh Allen or whatever the case may be. But if you have your guy that's in there getting your 25-ish carries a game, that makes your offense run so much more smoothly, as you've seen this last year, just because you can run the ball, or at least have the commitment to it. And we've talked about how the Chiefs have run the ball, but just not as effectively. And so I think that it's about finding that guy. Is Isaiah Pacheco that guy? Hopefully. The injury is one of those things, and especially for a running back, it does have a little bit higher of a tax, if you will. So I think with Andy Reid, it's going to be whether or not he has Kareem Hunt in his prime, I guess, to go to. If he has a Brian Westbrook in his prime to go to, a Jamal Charles in his prime to go to. So it matters about – it's this dependency we have on this position, but the Chiefs are like, yeah, we'll kind of focus on these other things and what this position can do other than just running the football. And I'm excited to see what Pacheco looks like going into week one with a full, healthy offseason. I think he is that guy.
It's pretty interesting. As much as we've talked about the Chiefs, we have not talked much about the defense. The majority of the picks they made, what did they make? They made about five or six defensive picks in the draft. Those guys have a good chance to be contributors. Those guys are going to be pretty critical to what this team's able to do big picture. Is there a world where the defense gets better, maybe, or at least stays the same next year with some of these younger players being contributors?
Well, in a way, the front office and the defense kind of painted themselves into a corner where they had such a great draft a couple years ago. They have to draft basically the same positions and cross your fingers and hope that it does get better and have contributors moving forward. It's kind of hard to say that a defense as good as it was is going to get better because it was the Chiefs defense. You know, I think it does get better, but the contributors that we've seen don't change that much because these are contract years. These are guys trying to get paid by the Chiefs or otherwise, whether it's, and I know we're not talking about secondary, but George Karlaftis, there's the entire 2022 secondary. So I think that this defense gets better, but because of what it is already, not because of who's coming in.
I wonder on that note, and you know, really kind of dialing in a little bit more. I mean, the defensive front from Kansas City, I mean, we obviously know Chris Jones is a monster and always has been. But I was concerned going into the draft about the fact that, you know, they lost Eric Nnadi, they lost Turk Wharton. You know, they did sign Jerry Tillery, but he's a veteran. Mike Pinnell was really the only guy that, you know, had significant size, really as a nose tackle type player. But I feel like through the draft, through the guys that they were able to get early on, if nothing else, they're younger on the defensive front, and probably they'll be able to be quicker in that regard too.
Oh yeah, and that's hugely important. And Cody Alexander, our head of football operations over at Field Vision, and I were talking last week how there's kind of two separate rooms within defensive ends, not just your defensive line, where you have your more traditional edge rushers of like Miles Garrett. Yeah, it's your defensive end. He looks like it. He fits the part. But then there's your Josh Sweats, where there's like 6'6", 250-ish, maybe like 230 more. But and they run a 4-4. And I think the Chiefs are kind of – they kind of bent that way. Who was the guy that they traded Uche with the Patriots? And so I think they're kind of leaning that way from a Minnehua and certain things like that. But at the same time, I've always thought that the Chiefs could have had one of the best defensive lines in football, or like led the league in sacks for a year, whatever the case may be, strictly because if Chris Jones wants to be the defensive player of the year, he can be. And now that George Karlaftis is in a realm of like, he can get double-digit sacks, they have another guy that can rush the passer, and we can talk about the nuances of Karlaftis' play and all that good stuff. But now they have, like you were saying, they have all of this youth and hunger mixed in with this veteran presence of Chris Jones. It's one of my favorite things. And I said this about the Rams last year, where they have this nice combination of, we know what to do, but also we have guys that can go do it. So it's the Chiefs trying to figure out, we're letting all these veterans walk, your Nnadis, your Turk Whartons, guys who have been around the organization for a long time, but also bringing in guys that have never been a part of this Super Bowl era, this window, if you will. So I think that's where the defensive line is on a smaller level, where they have guys that have been around for a minute, Chris Jones, George Karlaftis, that are at the top of the league, but bringing in guys that are hungry and still looking for success, I'm very excited for what the Chiefs defensive front can do this year.
Felix Johnson joining us, our Chiefs insider, obviously covering the NFL with Field Vision and a couple other places. A couple other things that I wanted to touch on. I saw you put a video out this morning, Caleb Williams. You said you're the only Caleb Williams guy in your office. I'm a Caleb Williams guy, so mm-hmm. Welcome to the club. I'm glad they got Ben Johnson there. I hope, you know, it's not too much instability, but I think the Bears have done a nice job. I still think the player's going to be good. What'd you take away from him in his first year?
Well, I real quick, does everybody remember that there were two teams that were 2-2 after the first month of the season? The Chicago Bears and the Philadelphia Eagles. The Eagles just went on to win every other game. The Bears lost just about every other game. And even within that game of when they lost to the Commanders with the Hail Mary and everything, there was one team that scored two touchdowns in that game. It was the Bears, and they still lost. That's neither here nor there. I think that Caleb Williams, if Matt Eberflus was worth anything as a coach, they would have figured something out, because they brought in so much talent wide receiver-wise. Their defense was so good the previous year. If you manage Caleb Williams the right way, I guess, and that's the hardest thing to say, because you need a Ben Johnson. He fits the archetype-wise, because Caleb Williams is more like Patrick Mahomes. You kind of need Andy Reid to say, all right, I understand what you're doing, but we have to do it this way. And so hopefully I think that Ben Johnson is the right guy to say, all right, we can take all of Caleb Williams's Caleb Williamsness, if you will, but let's point it in this direction and angle it that way. And from a structural standpoint, I think the Bears have done the right thing. A twice fired head coach as your defensive coordinator, he's probably not getting an opportunity. A 28-year-old offensive coordinator, he's not going to get an opportunity for at least a couple years. Ben Johnson could have gotten a head coaching job in multiple cycles. They brought over a lot of the Lions offensive coaching staff. So take away from your rivals to add to yourself. We'll see there. So I think that there's a lot of potential still in Caleb Williams' favor. It's just that it's kind of like the Shador thing, where it's like he's got all this stuff around him and he is who he is. That doesn't excuse him from being a quality prospect, and in Caleb's case, a better prospect than Shador ever was.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. As much as I like Shador, I like Caleb way, way more as a prospect. Well, we don't have time, unfortunately, so I'm going to give you another week to rethink and reset your take on Travis Hunter's ability to play two ways. So we'll have to
you
table
were the
that.
Only person last week who got
we'll
after
we'll have
me.
To we'll have to table that another week, let you guys really think about why you wouldn't play a great player on both sides of the ball. But you know, sorry, we're out of time.
Maybe 30 catches next year, maybe.
Felix Johnson, you'll find him at Felix R. Johnson on X. Find his work at Arrowhead Addict, Field Vision. Felix, we appreciate it.
Appreciate you guys.
Got a great email. We were talking about the NBA playoffs and all the threes and the Celtics, you know, historically missed, you know, a ton of them last night in their game one. Dax emails the show, and his idea is to somehow, basically more points are coming from corner threes because they're too close to the rim there, but there's no room on the court to extend that. So, you know, he's saying push it out, but I don't know how that helps you. You can't like eliminate, I don't think, a corner three unless you do, right? You just eliminate the corner three, might be what Dax is suggesting. They're not going to do any of this stuff because I think some people are totally fine. But I go back and Tommy, you mentioned maybe change it up late, and I'm looking at like the play by play of the game. I watched the end of regulation, then flip back over to the Royals, then jump back in to the end of overtime in that game last night. It's step back 19 footer, step back 23 footer, missed, man. I'm like, God, that's just like, there was a time where we would have, like, growing up, like, you'd have been smacked for playing that kind. And then, you know, kind of the Steph Curry generation came through and they hit a ton of those shots.
At least Steph Curry's
like, okay,
making them, you know, like at least Steph Curry's hitting those shots. I think that's the thing. Like, you can pin it on a guy like Steph Curry, who's maybe the best shooter ever to do it, and you're like, all right, well, like, that influenced a whole generation, and it did, and all of that. But at least Steph Curry's hitting those shots. In the game last night, the Celtics didn't hit any of them, and that contributed, you know, directly contributed to them losing that game in overtime. And you know, I know that you were like, well, that's the way that teams win games, and you're not wrong about that. But in that particular one game,
right,
make an adjustment. Change it up.
We're talking about two different things.
Do something different. And if you do like a little bit different, if you don't settle for those shots that clearly your team just doesn't have it on that particular night, and that happens, then do something different and you win that game against the Knicks.
And it's not like the Celtics can't. They have a lot of players that can score.
Sometimes you have an off night and you got to have a backup plan.
Absolutely. And they're going to be fine in this, and they won't go probably another game in this series where they miss 45 threes. And so can the Knicks keep up when they don't miss that many threes? Because the Celtics still almost won despite it. You know, it is a challenge of basketball right now. It is the same sort of thing has happened. There's been conversations about college basketball, and you know, some of these guys don't take enough. How many times have we talked to Shreyas about the fact that KU doesn't take enough threes, and in his mind, and you know, where the analytics are driving you these days. And like, the reality is it does help teams win games. And so go full circle. You look at Wichita State and they brought in a young guy that can hit a bunch of threes, and you're like, awesome. They've needed that for a long, long time. So it's just become a part of basketball. And it's even, you know, they push it back in the NBA further than college, but one like defining trait of the NBA players now, 3-and-D, right? Can be a 3-and-D guy. Those guys have a ton of value. Can you shoot threes and be a good defender? So it's just the way basketball's changing, and there's nothing we can do about it, as Max waxes poetic about the 76 Celtics. Like, this is where basketball is now.
Yeah, you mentioned KU. A quick note. First off, Norm Roberts, longtime assistant coach for the Jayhawks, retires yesterday. So we're going to see a shakeup in the staff for Bill Self. It'll be interesting to see what direction they go. Will he go younger? Will he go, you know, more aggressive? Time will tell on that. And then something else college athletic related that just came down. I don't know if you saw this. Brett Yormark gets an extension. So all the Big 12 presidents agreed to extend his contract. And so he will be, I think it's a 5-year deal, according to Pete Thamel. And so Yormark solidified in to be the commissioner of the Big 12 long term.
I didn't see that. It seems like a no-brainer. Is there anybody out there that doesn't think Yormark has done a good job? He's been bold, right? He's made a lot of big swings, the court at the Big 12 tournament. He's done a lot of big things. I think that's the way you have to be, though. right? Like you, they're not all going to work, but you have to swing big when you're the Big 12, because you're always going to be playing from behind the eight ball financially, at least until you're not. And that's, of course, the goal is to not be. But the reality is you probably always will be. So you've got to think bold. And he has. I mean, a lot of his ideas I've really, really liked. Some of them I haven't. But that's okay. I'm okay with the aggression. And because, you know, the alternative is Pac-12, right? The alternative is wherever we land with the ACC, if they don't do something bold whenever that time comes. And so, yeah, I'm good. I'm glad. I'm glad he wants to do the job for longer, because I think that kind of leadership is needed right now in college athletics.
Yeah, it's a 5-year deal. We'll run through 2030. So that came down this morning. And, you know, to your point, he's been very bold and very aggressive. And, you know, some of the things I know he's, you know, people have kind of made fun of some of the decisions. Like you've got remember the agreement that he made with the WWE, and you had, you know, the Big 12 championship belt, you know, that can't, like, just different things like that, that kind of people joke around about. But he's taking risks. He's taking big swings at things. And he's keeping the conference relevant. And so I think because of all of that, yeah, it makes a lot of sense to have him be extended.
And there's a timing component to it too. Like, you can be risky. You want TV networks to be in a good position to spend a bunch of money, which it's not really the climate for that at the moment, but maybe it is a year from now. So I think he's been good with his short game, and I think he's been good with his long game too, in evaluating when it's time to push the right buttons. And he's been right, by the way. Like, he was right to be so bold with expansion and everything with the Big 12. I don't know if that same thing happens if he tried that now instead of when he tried it. People, and, you know, with revenue sharing and all the things that are coming, I think, you know, schools are probably a little less inclined maybe to make bold moves. We'll see. But again, I haven't heard anybody that covers and follows the Big 12 that has not been satisfied with the job he's
totally
done
there. I mean, look, at the end of the day, the job of a commissioner in one of these power conferences is to be as proactive as you possibly can be in an ever-evolving college athletics landscape. You have to be able to make deals. You have to be able to negotiate. You have to be able to advocate, and you have to do it proactively. And when you compare and contrast it to the guy that he replaced in the Big 12, who was very reactive and let Texas and Oklahoma walk, and basically told lawmakers that, you know, he didn't see a viability for this conference when Texas and Oklahoma left, and wanted their help to prevent things like that from happening. And then you flip, you know, and you look at what Brett Yormark has done and how aggressive and bold he has been. I mean, the guy very early on in his tenure famously said that the Big 12 is, quote, open for business. That's been his mantra the entire time. And, you know, so I think it's easy. All you have to do is compare him to his predecessor, and you recognize and understand how much of an asset he's been to the conference.
It is. I'm glad you saw that note. I didn't see that note. But Brett Yormark, we're glad you're around. Stick around for us. We need it here in the Big 12. Okay. So let's look ahead then, Tommy, to tonight for the Royals a little bit while we have just a couple minutes left in this segment. It should be even more advantageous. Shane Smith has been a good story. That's who pitched for the White Sox. I saw Jonathan India talking about him after the game, in that he was like, yeah, he had really good stuff. And so they're not going to have that the rest of the way, though. They don't have bad starting pitching. It's not like awful, but it's not that good. You get Lugo tonight, Waka, Bubich, like the rotation. There's not a bad spot in the rotation, I guess, if you're the opposition. You want to face Lorenzen at this point, but he's even been good. They take the first one. They take down the best pitcher they'll face in that series. I think you just keep shrinking it down. Lugo, Waka, Bubich, let's win three more games here. I mean, you know, why not? If you're the Royals, it's going to take it. Detroit's not slowing down. Like, we just brushed over that earlier. Like, Detroit and Cleveland, we could be looking at a division here where you've got three teams that win 85 plus. And I think that's being conservative.
That's the way it was last season, right? I mean, Detroit came on strong towards the end. Cleveland, you know, it seemed like every time Kansas City won a game, Cleveland won a game last year. So this is nothing new for the Royals. They know what it's like to be in a division with these two teams. The Twins, you know, we'll see if they get healthy and if they're able to turn things around. But right now, it does look like mainly a three-horse race in that division, and the Twins would be the wild card. So you've got to take advantage of games against bad opponents at home. You have to be able to do that. And they took the first game in the set. That's huge. Off to a great start in that regard. Just continue on, this hot streak and keep playing the way that you're playing. Have elite pitching from your starters. Have, solid outings from your bullpen. And then do what you need to do to get 3 or 4 runs across the board, and you'll be in good shape.
Randy Jesse Early, a guy who blogs about the Royals, he put this out. This is wild. He just put this out. Here's a stat for you. The Royals have called up 5 pitchers this year, Tommy, from the minor leagues. Steven Cruz, Noah Cameron, Evan Sisk, Jonathan Boland, Taylor Clark. Those 5 guys have combined this year to throw 21 2/3, no runs allowed, only 7 hits. They're plentiful right now. Can we be unreasonable baseball fans and just expect a sweep of the White Sox? Like, can we just do that on a Tuesday in early May? Why not?
I mean, the White Sox are bad, and the Royals are the hottest team in baseball. So, I mean, I don't think that's an unreasonable goal. I don't know if I want to call it an expectation at this point.
Let's make it an expectation.
To me, winning the series is a reasonable expectation. Three or four.
You have to win 3 to win the series. Yeah.
Well, I get that. But I mean, 3 of 4, I think, is a reasonable expectation. Sweeping the series, of course, we would take that for sure. Like, exceeding those expectations, that would be a goal for sure. But, baseball's weird. I mean, you never know.
Let's be unreasonable.
Okay, fine. We'll be unreasonable.
They need to win the next 3 and score a combined 15 runs in those 3 games. How about that?
You think they're going to score 5 a game?
No. I'm not saying I think they're going to. I'm saying that's an unreasonable expectation.
Okay, unreasonable. Reasonably, if they can take 3 of 4 from the White Sox and they average 12 runs a game, I think that's reasonable over the next
3. Yeah, I do too. Because we haven't done this, we've been so focused on that stretch of the schedule. Boston, at Houston, at home then against St. Louis. They go on the road to San Francisco. Then they get road games against Minnesota. It's not anything like they saw earlier in the season.
It's not a cakewalk, though. I mean,
It's not like what they've had recently, but it's not like what they saw at the beginning of the year either.
Yeah.
So there's no reason, whether we're being reasonable or unreasonable or whatever, to think that, no, they're not going to win 10 out of every 12 games here, but they should be at least through that and be, ready to roll. And this race is going to be so fun to watch. And if you're setting your clock to it and you're setting your calendar to it, the next games against those teams we talked about come at the end of the month against Detroit at Kauffman. There you go. There they are. They're right there for you. And that should be a lot of fun. All right. That's it for Sports Daily. Tommy Mike chimes in, said, didn't I bet that the Royals would score 20 runs yesterday? No, Mike, I did not bet that. That would be a bad bet. I said, I want them to. And so that means they've got 17 runs to go over the next 3 games. We'll see if they can get there. It's pretty unlikely based on what we're seeing. Our thanks to Felix Johnson for hopping in with us. Shreyas Lada, our KU insider, joins us tomorrow. For Max, for Tommy, I'm Jacob. We'll see you then.